Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for September 19th, 2019, the Twin Cities edition. The Gabfest is live before a packed house at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. We expected quiet politeness, Minnesota nice, the quiet stillness of a night ice fishing under the stars. And instead, we have the raucous braying, like, crazed prairie mosh pit style. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. On my far left, the man who only came to Minnesota because he thought it was Iowa. Unfortunately, he's so blonde that he fits right in here. CBS News's, CBS's 60 Minutes, excuse me, John Dickerson.
You know, I went to camp here in Minnesota.
Did not.
Yeah.
Oh,
Grand Rapids, Minnesota.
Now I remember.
Camp Mishawaka. So, yeah. See?
Camp Mishawaka in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so I'm just saying that I've got deep roots in this community.
I came here once to do an interview in a mall. Does that count?
You did an interview in a mall?
In a mall.
Yeah.
Yeah, once. Does
you know,
that
there
count?
There are malls outside of Minnesota.
Yeah, but it was this mall.
Not Mall of America. That's
exactly.
True. There is only one Mall of America. But,
all over it.
I made a lanyard in this
state. That other voice, of course, is a woman who eats her salad with a comb and her steak with a samurai sword, Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School. On today's GabFest, will it take a Democrat with decent Midwestern values to beat Trump, or can a coastal socialist elitist do it instead? Then the rise of the chaos voter. Is America in deep trouble because we're suddenly overrun with nihilistic, crazy voters who want to burn it all down? Then, when it comes to writing fiction about politics, the best there is the Twin Cities' own Curtis Sittenfeld. We will talk about how to turn real political lives and real political wives into novels. And plus, we will have cocktail chatter. We are coming to you from the heart of Klobuchar country, the beating heart of the Klobocracy. The argument of her struggling campaign is that she is from a place that is the middle, not just geographically, but ideologically, and that only by nominating someone with those qualities, those credentials, will the Democrats win the 2020 presidential election. So, John, is she right about that?
Ooh, I heard someone say no already. That's a tough hometown crowd. She can't even get an amen in her own pews. Well, I'm sorry, Senator. It's
and she won by a landslide here.
Yeah, well,
outperform.
You know the old expression: no one says, "As goes the Minnesota Senate race, so goes the presidency."
Oh, yeah, that's true. That has not worked out.
Yes,
folks, before
dear Fritz Mondale would
and Hubert Humphrey too, right? Sorry.
He didn't win.
Okay.
So there you go. There's the answer to your question. First of all, by the way, can I say you made reference to the New York Times story about the eating salad with a comb. Creative solutions for emergency situations.
That's
what else does the story's about?
The story's about upbraiding a staff member for not having a fork.
Emily, I was just trying to make a dumb joke.
I'm sorry. I'm very literal-minded. Yeah. I don't let you get the punchline out. I'm so literal-minded.
Yeah. I just think a candidate who has emergency solutions for emergency moments is important. Okay. This is the great question in the race, because what everybody's trying to figure out is what's the shape of the electorate going to look like for the Democrats to win the nomination, and then in the general election. What's the coalition going to look like? And then is that coalition movable? Is it a campaign about persuasion, or is it a campaign about motivation, just your base? And the answer is that it's both. But there is a big debate about among the liberal side of the Democratic Party that says we need the kind of enthusiasm that Donald Trump was able to bring out in his party, and only through an enthusiastic appearance by the left will we be able to win. Other people say, well, if you look at the states that in the electoral map, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Iowa, even if those two may already be off the map, they have a disproportionate share of white working class voters in the Democratic Party, which has had struggled with them since FDR, still needs to be able to capture those kinds of voters. This is the big tension in the party. And what interests me is that what this requires is a lot of Democrats to basically do punditry about their neighbors. What do I mean? 88% of Democrats say they would vote for a woman to be president, but only 44% of Democrats think other Democrats would do that. So there, we know that electability is the number one thing that Democrats care about. So they have to basically be pundits about their neighbor. We, is Emily going to vote for a woman? Well, I don't know if she is. And then that determines my vote if I'm a Democrat. And so that gets into very sticky territory when it comes to these questions. What's the shape of the electorate? Will the traditional Democratic coalition turn out? And are we as, or are Democrats trying to convince new voters or just rev up their existing ones?
So Emily, so Klobuchar is obviously struggling, but Biden, who's like old man Klobuchar in the moderate accommodationist wing, is doing just fine. Is he doing just fine for some of the reasons John talked about, that Democrats believe that a return to normalcy is possible, or because people think he's the only one who can win, or because low information voters are stuck on him, or because he's a great candidate?
I mean, all of above, except I don't think we have a lot of evidence for the last possibility. I mean, right, I think we keep waiting for him. Right? Like, I think it would be great for the party if he was a great candidate. And I don't think he's bombed out, as I think we predicted before he got in the race, because he has been such a lousy candidate in previous presidential cycles. 21
weeks before Iowa.
Yeah, there's a long way to go.
Right.
I do think that his appeal has to do with other people's perception of who could get elected. I don't think that's crazy. I mean, I think there is this fundamental, you can be as feminist as they get and still think, is it possible that Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris could actually win? And do you want to take a risk this time around, given what happened to Hillary Clinton? Like, if a woman gets nominated and loses, is that going to be it for my lifetime? I wonder about that.
You know, it's
do you really sit and wonder and think, well, I'm maybe I should support a man because of that?
I don't think about it in that terms for myself, but I don't. I do think there's a tension between our ideals about how gender and race and other immutable characteristics, at least legal terms, should play, and then how we think they actually do play. And I don't think it's wrong to be asking those questions and trying to poll for that issue. And I also think when I was writing about Warren and following her around, she has this teacherly way about her that some people really cotton to and other people find off-putting. And I don't think you can separate the fact that she's a woman from the way in which that plays to different audiences.
One thing that's been interesting at the shape of the race where it is right now, there's a Wall Street Journal NBC poll that just came out, and 70% of Democrats say it would be fine if she was the nominee. That's the highest of all of them. She has increased that number.
So that says something. That's important.
And
Democrats.
I have no idea what it says, but it's because and Kamala Harris's numbers have gone south hard.
Huh.
And so what the NBC poll shows is Biden's at 31, and I believe this is true. Warren's at 26, and Sanders is at 13 or 14. Harris has gone from 13 down to like 5. She's really taken a hit, which is interesting, and I'm not sure why. You guys may have thoughts, but what it feels like is that Vice President Biden has a snowball in his hands, and it's spring, and he's got to keep it alive until July. And Elizabeth Warren, who's got a plan for everything, had 20,000 people show up in New York for her in her anti-corruption speech that she gave this week, is creating she's rubbing her hands together. Shade of the airplane.
Or she has a flower and it's waiting to blossom, right? Like, she's got the thing in her hand.
Leave the metaphors to John.
That could still open, but maybe it won't.
But the thing is that he's got the snowball, so she's trying to create heat, and that would make the snowball melt.
Well, the flower doesn't respond to the heat. No, he doesn't buy it. So, John,
all I can say is that my damn snowball has melted now.
No, I liked your snowball metaphor. I was trying to extend it. Why does it matter who Democrats will vote for and what Democrats think is going to happen as opposed to the whole electorate? Why,
don't
we want to know that answer?
Well, that's the question, whether you believe that the electorate is basically split. We're so partisan, there's nobody in the middle anymore, and it's just all about turning out your team. And then there's a new thing now, and we'll get to this in the chaos topic, but you know, negative partisanship is more powerful now than ever before. So it ends up being basically you don't vote for your person, but against the other person. So how will that play, and how do people anticipate that happening? Obviously, Democrats have a big turnout benefit in Donald Trump, but he has a turnout benefit with.
Does anyone think that whoever wins the presidency will win with zero independent votes? That seems wrong.
Well, we don't even know what independents really are anymore.
But they exist. There are a lot of them. Whoever they are, don't we care? What we want to know what they think.
Well, this is the question. A, who are they? Where do they live? And how many of them are there? Because if they live in states that don't matter, they don't matter.
That's true. I was going to say there are a lot of them in my state, and but you're right. Who
and then
cares?
The question is, are they people who... So
your state kind of matters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
But there's no independence here. They're all DFL or they're...
Well,
white nationalists.
You say that as it's
Democratic
bad,
Democratic Farmer Labor.
About
he's
that.
Dropping
Good
some DFL.
Them.
Nice. Hold on. Here's the thing, though. The question is, okay, let's say suburban women will be something that people pay a lot of attention to, because suburban Republican women, traditionally voted Republican, might have voted for Donald Trump because they were worried about the Supreme Court, are not going to vote for him this time. So are they going to stay home, or are they going to turn out and vote for the Democrat? So the question is then, how many of those are around, and what does staying home mean versus voting for a Democrat? What's the hurdle? And then also, there's an Andrew Yang fan out in the stands. And then there's the question of the white working class voter for Democrats. Are they pulling over those voters who voted for Obama and then for Trump? Is that a big enough group? Is that in these states, or is that a shiny object that shouldn't be chased because you'll end up losing voters in another part of the coalition that you need? All these are open questions. And the thing is, the punditry matters because it's determining how people are making their sorting decisions.
But
about
I
the
also
candidates.
Think you left one out, which is, will African American voters in key states turn out in numbers 100%. The way they did?
100%.
And we haven't seen Warren really catch on with those voters.
But he's at 13% in the journal poll, and Obama
with African American voters.
Biden's still way ahead. But then
she's the nominee, is that going to stick? If she becomes the nominee, just to ask this more specific question, do you, Emily, think this is already a two-person race? Is this already a Warren Biden race? And even Sanders is now really trailing far behind in his dinghy.
I've always been skeptical that Sanders could really grow his support. Ugh, I don't like actually using grow as a verb in the way I just did. Sorry about that.
Your
increase.
Plant metaphor is withering as you speak.
I got carried away. I've always been skeptical. I've always been skeptical that Sanders could really vastly increase his support. Like, he has a super committed base. I see you out there. We neglected you in the last election cycle. I feel regretful about that. And yet, I remain skeptical, though I really appreciate his presence on the debate stage. I think that if Biden stumbles, somebody else is going to be a real contender in this race. I kind of think it would be Buttigieg, probably. Whoa. But I don't really know. But,
do you think it's two-person, John?
We got so much time. Nah. No. I mean, but that's the shit. I mean, I think there are probably two lanes. And so right now you've got it in the liberal lane and the moderate lane. You've got the two people, and that'll be what it'll ultimately come down to. It'll be interesting to see how the sorting takes place between Sanders and Warren. A lot of Sanders voters... and I know this because of the embedded CBS, Kara Cordy and I were just talking about this. They have and she spends all her time with them.
Embed, that means the reporter who hangs with the campaign.
Because when I was one of those and I was out there all the time, I would hate when people would pretend they had been when they hadn't been. So I need to give credit to the person who's out there doing the reporting, not the person who isn't, which is to say me. Nevertheless, I have a microphone in front of me and can't. Anyway, what she was saying... is that Sanders voters have a passion and affection for him that is
not necessarily transferable.
Yeah, not necessarily transferable, and what's going to make it transfer? And what does that look like? And when does it happen? Because if you're any kind of candidate, you want something for your transfer of voters or affection.
So of course this could turn. I think Sanders and Warren are playing very nice with each other in a way that suggests actually some depth of allegiance and loyalty, as opposed to something that's more surface level and could disintegrate at any time.
Well, and also as he said when I interviewed him, this I did actually do, is he said, I've known her for 30 years. I mean, I'm not gonna. Here's also another thing. So say things go south for one of the two of them. Do they join forces and basically say we need to combine and go after the moderate or whoever's in that lane? Presumably it's Biden, but could be Buttigieg, it could be Klobuchar.
Do you think, Emily, that the Democrats are positioning themselves on issues in a way that's going to be productive for the general? We see this sort of aborted push on Kavanaugh. Can I ask my question?
No.
The abortive push on Kavanaugh on impeachment, the general push on impeachment. Warren has made this very interesting corruption attack on
that
Trump.
I think that polls really well.
So that does that feel to you like the main front, the main way to win in 2020? Or do you have a sense about what they should be doing that would help them in the general?
I'm just kind of going off of the polls here and other people who look at the polls, but I think when you look at economic issues, the way Warren is framing them, yes, that looks like a good argument to me. It directly goes after the same discontent that Donald Trump has successfully gone after. It's populist, but it's taking the target of the populism as like America's corporate fat cats. It's addressing inequality. She has a really, I think she's very good at explaining what she thinks has gone wrong with the economy since 1980. And I think that's compelling. But there are other things that I don't think there's.
What if it's right? What if the election's more about identity and those kinds of issues and not an intellectual case about the sharing the wealth and
shared
prosperity?
When you say identity, what do you mean, John?
I mean voters that...
Are you in a liberal Harvard professor elitist?
Yes.
So,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, Trump will try to make it about that if she's the general election candidate. I mean, the thing about Warren is that she actually is from Oklahoma and... grew up, but when
you get into identity fights, it's not like, well, actually, I'm from... I mean,
well, she tells all those stories. I mean, she's made that very central. And, you know, whether that is enough to combat the fact that, yes, she did work at Harvard, I'm not sure. But she has an actual, true, organic response to those attacks.
Here's one thing I wonder about responding to those attacks and how it's going to take place and what forum and what one does as a candidate who we know that Donald Trump is going to get the nomination of his own party, or we assume, barring some crazy event. So today he passed on along a tweet about Congresswoman Ilhan Omar that said that she was dancing on 9/11. Okay, it was a smear. She wasn't. When he passed along that tweet, this is, by the way, the president of the United States, he said, this is the new Democratic Party. So this is super obvious, right?
We're back. Yeah.
This is negative partisanship. This is basically create an image of the opposite party that is so objectionable, you won't vote for them. And
it's a lie, sounds like.
Right. So my point is, if that is where we are and it's, what date are we? September 18th? Imagine the escalation. How do you think about that in terms of a candidate who is in the opposite party responding to something at that level?
I mean, whoever the nominee is going to face this. It's not going to matter. And so I think to be scared off from a more liberal candidate for that reason is a mistake. I don't think that Biden is necessarily going to be more effective at responding to that. I mean, one thing, Biden has his strengths, and I'm happy to lay them out, but when I was listening to the word salad problematic answer he gave...
With which you can eat.
With which he ate with a cone.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, man. When I was listening to that answer he gave about in response to segregation, which just went all over the place, I thought, oh, my God, can you imagine the debates between Trump and Biden? There's going to be... Right? They're going to insult each other, and then they're going to, like, both of them make
no
sense.
Well, they're both slightly...
Like, dotty. Yeah. Like, it's just going to be this really weird combination of nastiness and, like, wandering into the wilderness answers.
Well, you know, and here's an interesting, maybe it's not an interesting question, but it's one on my mind. Will the when people in the Democratic Party are thinking about who their nominee is going to be and what they're going to need to do against the likely Republican nominee, do they think about it in terms of the debate stage context? Because it turns out debates don't actually affect the.
I think it matters,
do they think about it in another context, and should that change the way they think about the candidate?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Can I ask you a different policy question? So
as long as I get to answer it with a question.
No. Nope. I'm going to ask David. So here's my question to either or both of you. So in my mind, the weakness right now among the liberal Democrats is support for Medicare for All, because the idea of forcing people on to government-run health care that costs $30 trillion is not popular. The public option, the idea of choice, strengthening Obamacare, Medicaid for All, or some possibility of Medicare, yes. But the Bernie version, which is in 4 years we end private health insurance, is not popular. So what's, if Warren's the candidate, what's she going to do? Because she's sticking to that position more than I expected.
Although in this strange way where she's sticking with it but not sticking. I mean, she says, I'm on his plan, but then had that...
She never answers whether
she shilly-shallied on the
right.
cost question.
Is she leaving herself room to say something like, "Oh, we get there eventually, but not on the
timeline"? Sure. And I think as long as the Republicans do things where they're going after Obamacare, which they seem to be doing with legal challenges, the Democrats, it's a stronger issue for Democrats than Republicans, and you don't have to pin yourself to that.
I just feel like she has pinned herself to it more than I would have expected. And the people at the last debate, sorry to be so debate-centric, who gave the best answers were Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg. Harris brought up the lawsuit you just mentioned against to bring down Obamacare, and Buttigieg says, "I trust Americans. Why can't we have choice for all?"
Yeah, so the question is... Go ahead, you can applaud for Emily.
For Mayor Pete.
For Mayor Pete, Emily, you can applaud for whoever you want. This is America. You can applaud for yourself. Congratulations.
Oh, I like that.
Congratulations, everyone. The thing that is interesting to me about Medicare for All, first of all, you know, the polling for it is highly volatile. So people in theory like it, and then once you start saying what's in it, it drops like a rock. So that's one problem. The second thing is, in the context of a general election, what is the value argument behind it that a Democratic nominee is going to use, assuming they are in support of that, to make a larger case to the public? Like, is it, we don't think 30 million people should be without health care? Do we think your costs are too much and you're one illness away from bankruptcy? Do we think 146 million people on private insurance should have a new complexity in their life?
Definitely not that one.
What interests me is whatever the set of policy proposals are that a Democrat runs on, it seems to me that the only person who has, and you mentioned Kamala Harris, she was able to take the issue and make it about President Trump. That seems to me to be the thing that a Democrat needs to do. And in the context of all the healthcare debate, almost none of them have done that successfully in a way that has real throw weight in a general election. And it seems to me if you can't do that, you're not ready for the general election.
Yeah.
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. And today's Slate Plus segment is going to be the Q&A with our audience here in the Twin Cities. So go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
All right,
dear Minnesotans, I'm going to read you some statements, and I want you to let me know if you agree with them by applauding if you do, okay? I fantasize about a natural disaster wiping out most of humanity such that a small group of people can start over. I think society should be burned to the ground. When I think about our political and social institutions, I cannot help thinking, just let them all burn. We cannot fix the problems in our social institutions. We need to tear them down and start over. Sometimes I just feel like destroying beautiful things.
Okay. Really? That's like the least appealing one.
So an astonishing percentage of Americans believe some of these statements. 40%, according to a recent study, believe that we need society to be burned to the ground. This was found by three social scientists, two Danish, one American. I like to have two Danish for breakfast. And the paper is called A Need for Chaos, The Sharing of Hostile Political Rumors in Advanced Democracies. Tom Edsel of the New York Times wrote a very interesting column about that. And we're going to couple that today with another social science paper called Democracy Devouring Itself, The Rise of the Incompetent Citizen and the Appeal of Right-Wing Populism. And the reason we're going to talk about that is these two papers taken together paint a truly dire picture of where we are as a country. And they suggest that the United States and, in fact, possibly all democracies are even in worse shape than we suspected. So, Emily, I'm going to ask you, I could do this, but what did this Need for Chaos paper find? Why is it so unsettling?
So I have to say, I think that I read this like 10 times, like 40% of people agreed to this. And then I decided that if you look at those questions closely, okay, if you answer them literally and you're talking about actually burning things to the ground, that's bad. But I bet a lot of people, I could imagine this, answered them much more in this way of like, yeah, I'm mad about some stuff. And this is a flawed world and rigged system we live in. And when you think about it that way, it's not as alarming.
But can we describe what the study found? Yes.
Well, what it found was that these folks like are really prevalent in those numbers you said, but that also they are likely to be spreading information on social media. This is this big question. Is social media changing the way people communicate in a way that then takes these fringy views or these disordered, blow everything up views and allows them to spread and gain political influence in a way that is destabilizing for the democracy? The counter view is like, there's nothing new about this. We've always had rumors. We've always had disinformation. The fact that they're spreading more gets exaggerated. That when you look at people's news consumption, almost everybody is actually looking at multiple news stories and news sources, including mainstream ones. And we're too concerned about Pizzagate and the Sandy Hook libelous lies we should stop obsessing about this because it doesn't actually make that big an effect. And there are political scientists on both sides of this argument. Right.
Well, there's a lot going on.
I didn't answer your question. Yeah, no.
All right, so I'm going to take the side, which is the people who want to burn it all down are very dangerous. So what this study, these political scientists found was that when you look at sort of how disinformation spreads, it's not necessarily spread by people who have a partisan motivation. Yes. It's not necessarily people who are spreading it because they want to take down the Democratic candidate or the Republican candidate. It's spread by people who want to take down the institutions themselves. They do not believe the institutions. They want to increase chaos in the system. And that there has been a marked increase in the amount of chaos in the system because the ability of people to spread this information has grown. The number of people who believe in spreading this information has grown. And it's quite dangerous. And the elites, and that coupled with this other paper, which sort of said the elites have lost control of media, they've lost control of politics, they've lost control of the kind of master narrative of society, and that we're in a situation where the kind of nihilist, destructive, anarchic forces that these folks believe in have overtaken us, and there is no way to bring them back in. There's no way to rein them in.
Right. So there's a lot of it. One thing is that the Pizzagate and the most extreme stories and conspiracy theories that exist on both the left and the right are only a part of the puzzle. What happens when you have chaos voters is they're happy to see chaos about a whole range of stories. And so it's not just the ones that are the most absurd, but any of the normal conflicts between urban-rural, religious, non-religious, religious, black-white, they are happy to see disinformation, misinformation create just chaos and cacophony. What that does is, so that's bigger, because then that's not people who believe there's a pedophile ring in the bottom of a basement, in a basement of a pizza parlor that doesn't even have a basement. They help keep the noise and the fight on Twitter or social media And so that's a bigger group than just the crazies. What that does is it shreds attention just in general, right? So you now have the what used to be the, as Andy Card, the former chief of staff under George W. Bush said, is what used to be the fringe is now the rug, is that the fringe is now in the middle of the conversation. And so it's harder to get that out of the way and then say, okay, now I'm just going to focus on this one thing. The other thing that social media has done is the something called the illusory truth effect, which is once a person who's mildly into chaos sends something out that we know is in bad faith. We know is I mean, the Ilhan Omar dancing on 9/11. They know it's in bad faith. They just don't give a damn. Once they spread that, once that hits you first, even the minute, when you guys know this, but even the minute you then are told, no, that's not true, the first mover advantage of the false news still sticks in your head. And if the person who wants to act in bad faith keeps hammering home the thing that everybody says is a lie and keeps doing it, it sticks in your head. And that's the real danger. So you have chaos voters, then you have voters who are anxious to be fed affirmation, not information. And I think that creates a much larger portion of
Emily,
chaos.
I know you're about to jump in, but can I just make one more point about this, which is that the chaos, one of the things that's paradoxical about Trump is that Trump is an agent of chaos who then offers himself as a solution to chaos. That one of the things he's been so successful at doing is to create, and retweeting this Omar thing is an example of it, to create the mistrust and create the corruption, create the anxiety, create the fear, and then say, I am the answer. Only I can fix it. And to do it with authoritarianism as his answer. And so there's this paradox in Trump, which is that he claims to be against chaos and yet is an agent of it. And I think if you look across in a bunch of countries, if you look in Hungary, if you look in Russia, if you look in Brazil, Poland. We have this phenomenon multiplying across the world. And it's the same set of things, which is somebody who posits there's chaos in society, increases the amount of it, and then comes forward with authoritarian, anti-democratic, anti-representative government solutions to fix it. And that's a fucking terrifying place to be.
So I want to add the role of the mainstream media to this conversation, because if the mainstream media didn't amplify the tweets, etc., and spend endless hours debating them on these fake cable news panels 100%. That are ginned up for conflict and treat the news like entertainment, then the social media postings would have much less influence. And the other thing about these chaos voters, these kind of gremlin voters, is that you don't think that's right?
No, I do think it's right. Can I interrupt and have a conversation? Is that yes, the mainstream media has totally done that. But that's because the mainstream media is subject to all these forces of fragmentation and loss of audience. And what the mainstream media is suffering from is it no longer has the authority it once had. And it's lost the authority not because it's covered a lot of tweets. It's lost the authority because media has itself just turned into this fragmented universe. And CBS News, I mean, sorry, John, I know CBS News is wonderful. You work for it. It's great. CBS News does not have the gravity and weight that it had 10 years ago, 30 years ago, 60 years ago. And it will never get it back.
Right.
And so I don't think it's enough to say, oh, it's the mainstream media is doing this, you know, is doing the dirty work for the president. I think it's, you have to say, these forces of fragmentation have affected the media and government.
I just feel like that lets us off the hook way too much. Like, yes, there are these market forces, and it's also true that we present ourselves as having some higher authority, having some moral compass that guides us, having some elevated principles, and then we act, in fact, often.
Who's the we?
I'm not going to let anyone off the hook. I feel like that's wrong, but I especially feel this about television. No,
it's a small fraction of people who are watching. It's like cable news, and it's a small fraction of audience. And you're talking about Fox, which is one of these agents of fragmentation.
I think it's true about television across the board, and to some degree, newspapers and others.
We don't need to
entities too. You can broaden it even more.
Yeah,
if you would like.
We can. Well. So
there's no institutional legitimacy for anything anymore.
Right, but that's because
we have also handed it over.
We haven't handed it over.
We have.
No, we have.
We have.
No,
I think we
it's
have.
A, it, No, this is something we haven't handed it. Media
you're defending
has not,
us. No. Like,
it's contributory. It's not just a single. It's exactly the complexity that you talk about. But as Emily said, whether it's the New York Times or CBS or Time Magazine or any of those legacy big organizations that spend a lot of time making sure that there are standards. Their job in part is to fight against. Now, they're businesses, so they have to have people.
It's the Catholic Church. It's the U.S. Senate. It's the House of Representatives. It's every major, it's universities. Every significant institution in this country has much less credibility than it did a year ago, 10 years ago.
Right.
But that's every single one. It's not just like some inevitable occurrence that we have no responsibility for.
Right.
We do have responsibility for, and universities also have. Right.
Yeah, right. Anyway. So, and also, most of those institutions that you named still have people inside them who say, we still believe in our existing and original standards, and we're going to fight against these forces, and we shouldn't let those forces of darkness prevail, even if some of them are coming from within our own house. And we have to keep those standards, because without standards, it's madness. And so that's...
Can we go back also to the Gremlin voters? That's now I'm thinking of them. So I think there are some people who are like, you know, cackling over burning down the world. I in my gut feel like there are more people who just feel like, no matter what I do, my life doesn't change and get better. These politicians, they yap about solutions. It doesn't matter. And I see this kind of entertainment faux news that, you know, particularly Trump has been so, so good at promoting and peddling. And I'm just going to like laugh at it, because there's no point in really paying attention to this game. My life hasn't changed enough, et cetera. Well, I'm not saying those people are correct, but I don't think that is a crazy view in itself at all.
Well, and it's not just, I mean, this president has taken the link ever since basically candidates use the same processes that are used to sell Lemon Fresh Pledge or any other consumer product. It has been on a straight trajectory to creating a situation where people feel like I'm being gamed the way I'm gamed to buy mud flaps on the new car. And so once that happens, it detaches from what's happening in their real lives. That's been going on before Trump. People obviously feel it now, which is why it's so striking that politicians who, in any party, the way you change that is you inspire people, is that you create these fires inside of each voter by kindling something in them that they feel in a common way that then brings them and lifts them through whatever it is that you appeal to them. And the paucity of inspirational speech in politics is striking. I mean, because that's the only way you can beat it.
I think that is just... I mean, really idealistic in a way that doesn't resonate. I think when you have the inequality that you have, when you have a lack of a shared, you know, commonality, a shared sense of what the country is, a lack of a shared sense of mission of the country, the idea that political rhetoric is going to overcome these enormous political, economic, you know, social, religious, cultural forces seems hopeless.
Right. Well, No, it's obviously not just rhetoric, but if you're going to do it, you have to. So, clearly, we've been at worse places than this. We did have a civil war, and, you know, 600,000 people died. So we've been in worse places, and
example. That's literally the one example.
I don't find that reassuring.
Well, 1968 things were a lot worse.
This is worse than 68.
Well, 1968 was pretty bad. You had the National Guard.
You were born.
People dying in...
I was just,
you had people getting shot in major cities, you know, Jersey City, 30 people dying, Detroit, 36 people dying. Like, we don't yet have that. So
we have massacres. We do. They're massacre. It's different. It's different.
Sure. But
El Paso, that's
Bobby
a political
Kennedy,
shooting.
And you have Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. I'm saying that was 1968 was a pretty tough year. So my point is that politics was a lot different back then. You don't have the structural things in place that would create correction that you had.
You had facts in a different way. You had authoritative news sources that had a greater share of the market than
they had a greater share because you didn't. There were people. I mean, certainly, if you look at the Wallace candidacy, and you look even at the Goldwater candidacy, there were a lot of people supporting those two candidacies who felt that the shared facts were all made up.
Right. Now, see, they didn't have an organizing principle.
Right.
Which goes back to David's point about the chaos voters. One of the things that this paper finds, and that is true, is that there is a convening force of social media that they didn't have in 64 and 68. And that is what makes this different now and makes it much, much harder to beat back with rhetoric because you're immediately atomized unless you can kindle something in individual Americans. And to suggest that that Americans across the country are so barren that they can't be moved, that's
more
chaos.
Well, you also
try
to move people with results. I mean, I actually think Mitch McConnell, right, while I wouldn't give him the inspiring award, when he emphasizes, look, we've gotten 150 judges confirmed, that is a real legacy, a real accomplishment for his party. That should move his base, right?
Right, but they're in control. This is a
well,
theory
that's a
for,
problem with not right, being in control
right,
of an organ
sure,
of government.
Yes, yes.
And it also goes to the fact that the Democrats trying to investigate and take testimony seems pretty ineffectual at this point. Now, maybe there's nothing that can be done about that. These subpoenas are in court in this kind of months-long way, but it feels like, hey, you know, you said you were going to go get Trump's tax returns. Where are they? Like, they're the use of the House as a you're in control. I don't feel like we're seeing a whole lot of fruits of that labor.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
GabFest fans, we are so happy to have Curtis Sittenfeld with us here in the Twin Cities. Curtis is the author of 5 novels and 1 amazing collection of short stories. Her novels include Prep, Eligible, which is a retelling of Pride and Prejudice, American Wife, which is a fictionalized biography of Laura Bush. Her short story collection, You Think It, I'll Say It, is amazing. It's just so good. I read that it was being adapted for television. True? True-ish?
Should be true.
Less true than it once was.
That's a thing that happens, but they totally should adapt that. I will watch that.
Thank you.
For our purposes, Curtis is also the American novelist who is most attentive and best at writing about politics. American Wife is a masterpiece. She also wrote a serialized novella about the Obama inauguration for me at Slate back in 2009. I bet you've forgotten that.
No. I wondered if you had. You and I are the only ones.
If we were the only ones who read it.
Now that it's been revived in my memory.
She wrote a short story about Hillary Clinton for Esquire and also for her collection. And now, Be Still, Our Beating Hearts, she is working on a book with the working title of Rodham. It's about.
I wonder what that's about.
About what if Hillary
Hugh
had
Rodham.
Met Bill at Yale Law School in the way she really did. They'd fallen in love, but she hadn't married him. Had gone on to lead a life apart from his. So I am so excited to read this book, which we will get a chance to read next year at some point. So Curtis, you tweeted this week. you had a great tweet this week. I seriously think today anyway that I may have written the great American novel. You might not realize it because I'm female and because the cover will probably be either a dress or a woman whose face you can't see. So this is just an FYI.
That's awesome.
So why are you so excited about it? Why are you so excited about Rodham?
First of all, she has to finish it. It's a good moment to be excited about it.
It is. It's funny because I think that when I tweeted that, and I can understand why in retrospect, people thought I was completely finished with the book, which I would say I actually am 90% finished, but you all know there's a difference between being 90% finished writing a book and 100%. I think I had, so there have been moments when I've thought, like, this is not coming together as I had imagined. This is, I've been working on it for 2.5 years. And I think I will say yesterday I was having a day where I thought, oh my God, like, it's even better than I hoped. And so you have to
so
celebrate
awesome.
Those days.
How, yeah. How does
they're
that,
rare.
Does that roller coaster go like this, or does it go like the EKG chart?
Well, so I actually feel like the general rule, I think, is that if you feel like you had a great day of writing, and then you look back at what you've produced, you're usually wrong.
Yeah.
And if you feel like you had a really terrible day and you look back, you also are probably wrong. Like that it's,
oh, I was going to say you're right.
I mean, I think that it's less. I mean, again, there are times when I'll, and I wrote, I mean, I know this is in the year 2019, some of us have lost our attention span, so I know this is a little bit daunting, but it might be like a 500-ish page. But there's a lot to say about if Hillary hadn't married Bill, it turns out.
Yeah.
I think that part of being a novelist is just sort of getting to the other side of that.
Almost no one writes novels about politicians, and no one writes novels about first ladies. You're now going to have written two novels about first ladies.
Well, sort of, because of course, if Hillary
hadn't,
yeah.
But you know what I'm saying here.
I do know what you're saying.
Why were you drawn to Laura Bush? Why are you drawn to Hillary Clinton?
So I think it's fair to see a pattern, although I would say, like, my interest in Hillary Clinton is more as, like, the first female major party nominee for president. Like, that's sort of the category I see her, rather than as primarily.
Well, particularly if she doesn't marry Bill, you've actually converted her into that.
So are you saying David's defining her merely by her husband and not by her own achievements?
I mean, I think she is an issue. Well, actually, there are two things that sort of made me, or like prompted me to write the novel. One was when Esquire reached out and said, do you want to write a short story? This was in early 2016. And they said, do you want to write a story from the perspective of Hillary Clinton? And the funny thing was, I had been invited, because of my book, American Wife, I had been invited to write a few essays about Hillary Clinton. And I had said, no, thank you, like during the 2016 election leading up to it. I feel like almost nothing can be written about, like, who Hillary Clinton is to the American public that hasn't already been said. But to think, like, what does Hillary think of us is a completely different question. Like, what does the world look like to her? Not what do we think of her, but what does she think of us? The other thing that I had this sort of slow realization is, leading up to and after the 2016 election, for plenty of grade school children knew Hillary Clinton as the presidential nominee, but they actually had no idea who Bill Clinton was, let alone that she had been married
lucky
him.
Children.
And it's
lucky well, children.
But it's and it's it raises this question of if we had, like, we've been.
We all experienced her with
and,
all that baggage.
Yeah, and there's many things we've been told about her for 30 years, you know, some of which have been, you know, some were true, some were false, some were sort of true, but it's like if you could strip away a lot. Like, I sometimes do think, like, if she were, you know, the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, or if she were, you know, like the president of a university, and under some very random circumstances, I ended up sitting next to her at a dinner party, I feel like I'd be like, that woman is so smart and interesting and accomplished. And instead, somehow it's like I have thoughts about, like, her headbands from, you know, 1992 and...
Right. One of the things I really liked about the Esquire story,
By the way, also the press's fault. I mean,
yes.
The obsessions with a lot of her and her pantsuits and all that stuff.
Yeah, and actually that's like the point of this Esquire story, is to write about Hillary's experience of a journalist coming in repeatedly in her life in this invasive way. A journalist who, reminded me of different people. I was going to say, though, that Hillary says incredibly bland things in your story, even as she's thinking more interesting thoughts. And I wonder if that kind of voice and dialogue continues in the novel, and whether that's hard because when someone
the bland
is,
voice or the interesting
voice. Well, the internal voice, of course, is fascinating. But if you are keep having to produce these banal political sound bites, like how do you deal with that?
Oh
with
no,
novelist?
It's much juicier. I probably okay, like it, because it's. I mean, first of all, you know, again, we all, including me, of course, receive her as a public person, but before she was a public person, you know, she was a private person. And so, and that's kind of, in a way, to me, that's the appeal of a 500-page novel, that you can, like, get to the point where the person is a public person, but then you also can show them when they're, like, 24 or 32, and, like, maybe with a coworker, or with someone they date, or someone they have a crush on. Because I do feel like we... it's the very weird thing where we have this access to kind of like very detailed information about these public figures, but then we sort of pretend that they're not real three-dimensional people like us, like we are and they're not.
Have you met either Hillary Clinton or Laura Bush, and would you want to if you haven't? And have you talked, if you have, to them about their fictional selves?
So I think the short answer to like almost all those questions is no.
I feel so sure Laura Bush has read your book. She's a librarian.
Well, so people have said that, but I do think she's so famous that I think that she had to develop mechanisms for like tuning things out, that if I said like, or if someone said to you, you know, Curtis wrote about a book about you, Emily, maybe you would find it irresistible.
Yeah, well, I'm not super famous.
I mean, you're medium famous, but
no.
among Slate Plus listeners, you're super famous.
Very specific.
You know, and New York Times readers know. So I do think, like, if I were her, I wouldn't have read it. And no, I have never met Hillary Clinton. I will say, leading up to, and then when American Wife was published, which was in 2008, I would sometimes dream about Laura Bush. And in the dream, we were introduced, and she knew I had written a novel about her, and she thought it was distasteful, but she was too polite to kind of call me out on it. And I will say, the Laura Bush dreams have gone away, but I have dreamed a few times of Hillary.
So do you have, and do you immerse yourself in Hillary Clinton so that the new character you create grows out of that? Or is it, do you recognize two totally separate people?
That's an excellent question. So I have immersed myself in Hillary Clinton. Like, I put on my Hillary Clinton costume.
Yeah.
And I do it. I try to sort of like it's supposed to be a realistic. The premise is supposed to be realistic. Like, really, what would have happened? And I will say, I'm probably giving away way too much, but I've had very early readers who have two of the four, like, you know, and two are like related to me, but they're actually my harshest critics. But they've said reading the early passages where they fall in love at Yale Law School, like is so convincing that I get upset knowing they're not going to be together, and then I reassure myself that they are together in real life.
Oh my God, that seems to be like right where you want to be.
I know. I will say, I know, weirdly.
See, she did write the great American novel.
That's great.
I've gone so far down the rabbit hole that literally, this is not a joke, I recently was like, should I move to Fayetteville, Arkansas? Like, it's actually, it sounds delightful. And then I
That's
picked
a very
out
Robert
my
Carroll
house.
Kind of move.
You picked out your house on Zillow or something?
Yes.
Nice.
It's like in this lovely historic neighborhood. But yeah, like Fayetteville, I mean, so Hillary moved there in August 1974 when Bill's running for Congress in Northwest Arkansas. And it sounds like a really great, you know, like, academic, sort of hippie, like all the liberals in the state go there, and even though it's near
the Austin of Arkansas.
So you have lived, I think you've lived, you grew up in Cincinnati, you've lived in Washington, Philly,
St. Louis,
now you're in the Twin Cities. I want you to rank those cities.
So I will say this, again, you know, I've lived in other places, but I have lived in the Midwest for a lot of my life. And I feel like it's really shocking to me that I didn't know how great the Twin Cities are. Even that they're, and I swear, I'm not just saying this because like it's a great, like there are tons of writers. It's politically progressive. It's beautiful, like the lakes. It's actually a great. I might have to say that Minneapolis is number one. Can I say one other thing? Because of course I was listening. Yeah. I definitely think Elizabeth Warren is electable.
Why do you feel so confident about that? As someone who's thought about female politicians a lot.
To me, it's like, why isn't she elected? Like, so many things. It's like, they have to happen, and then we know they can happen. And it just seems like politics is so fluid, and there's so many things that, you know, it seems implausible, and then afterwards it seems inevitable. Right. And I also, in terms of the thing you guys were saying about Biden, like imagining a Biden-Trump face-off, I really sincerely think, and I like Amy Klobuchar, I like Kamala Harris, I like Elizabeth Warren, that like any woman who's reached the level of success they have has probably withstood a lot more like ugliness and criticism and is probably tougher than any man who's achieved.
Just drop the mic. Curtis Sittenfeld. Is the author of the forthcoming novel, Rodham, and the author of a whole bunch of other great novels. Curtis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Curtis.
All right, let's go to cocktail chatter. When you're having one of the very, very many craft brews that the city has, Emily Bazelon, what will you be chattering about?
I was tremendously saddened this week by the death of Cokie Roberts, who is, I mean, I feel lucky to think of her as like one of the female journalists I might aspire to be. She seems to be someone who, everyone I've talked to who has met her thought that she was a lovely person. Mm-hmm. She just seems to be one of those sparky, generous presences that even in the cutthroat, elbow-throwing city of Washington is able to transcend some politics. And maybe some of you saw it. There is this amazing photograph circulating this week of Cokie Roberts with Susan Stamberg and Nina Totenberg many years ago. They're fairly young women. They're wearing clothes that look very much of that era, and they're pioneers. They are changing the profession. They are these female voices on public radio before it was anything like easy to be that person, and I feel so grateful to them and all the work they did. It's just a good time to think about that.
John Dickerson, what's your chatter?
Amen to that. You know, another thing about Cokie is that all the stories you hear, or lots and lots of the stories you hear, are things she did out of the way, people she reached to who were not of her same age and was good to, you know. Yeah,
yes,
you want those
right.
Stories. Okay, so as all of you know, I'm trying to finish a book. I'm still trying to finish it. It's on the presidency and how the job is different than the thing we talk about during the campaigns. During my research, I was looking for a book that told people how to prepare to vote, not like where to go with the polling place, but how to study the issues, how to think about a president. And it turns out there aren't very many of those books, but they were written for the elections of 1900, 1908, and 1912. I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened in 1904.
And they're all in a Ziploc bag.
Well, I ordered one of them. It is here tonight in a plastic bag, and it smells like your grandmother's basement. Because that's probably where it came from. And it's called Great Issues and National Leaders, Live Questions of the Day Discussed, The Voter's Guide for the Campaign of 1900.
Who are those people?
That's McKinley and that's William Jennings Bryan. Okay, so I opened it, and what fell out but this three-page little pamphlet. So this, to me, was more, this is a key word, to me, was more interesting than the book. What is the pamphlet? It is the agent's key to how to sell this book about how to prepare yourself.
That's so awesome.
This pamphlet is for your private use. It is the key with which you are to open the door to success in selling this book. No one can succeed at any work without preparation, and the more thorough the preparation, the better the success. We give you this as a guide. We advise you to memorize the description word for word. It's four pages. We advise you to memorize this word for word.
They were less distracted in 1900, huh?
They had a lot of time. We advise you to memorize word for word and then beat it all you can. But be sure you never do worse. And ladies and gentlemen, I tell you, that's just what I'm going to do. Because this is the most complete and in every respect the finest campaign book issued. It is authentic, with new and fresh, not printed from old plates, profusely illustrated with portraits and illustrations. So it turns out this is not the actual book. The actual book is 500 pages. This is a teaser, okay? So, and this, what this teaser was for, it's got a cloth cover.
It does really smell.
Yeah, it's really.
Okay, are you going
to? I will turn to it, but you may, we may have a little show and tell. Yeah, and it'll leave a little mark on your hands. Anyway, this is it. This is the teaser that this is in the era of, do you want to show the class what the pictures are like inside?
This is Mrs. William McKinley.
Yeah. It's chock full of photographs, the finest, not made from old plates. These are fresh, new photographs. This is the era of the door-to-door salesman. So chaps in like lumpy suits and those hats they were always adjusting are racing towards the front door, pushing aside the encyclopedia salesman and pushing aside the Fuller Brush salesman so they can get to your front
door. Teddy Roosevelt.
And show you Teddy Roosevelt, the vice presidential nominee to McKinley. And boy, wasn't that an important decision when in January, September 1901,
whoa,
McKinley
dies. Adlai Stevenson, the elder, Illinois. Was the vice presidential candidate
nominee
for the Democrats.
Wow.
Who knew?
Not
I didn't even
me.
Know there was an Adlai Stevenson the Elder.
May I mark you down for a copy? What's it going to take to put you in a new administration today? So the salesman would have been propelled by this pamphlet, which I've made a copy because this is it's falling apart. But anyway, and they would be propelled by the words on these pages. Call attention to the fact that this is the most handsome and magnificent book, the cover representing what the book stands for, a thoroughly patriotic, nonpartisan book, a book which will be an ornament for the home table, as well as most interesting, useful, and valuable book for immediate use. So from that breathless description, you can see basically what we have on cable news today. David, pass me back the book, please, because it is written in the chattiest, which I think we should return to, frankly, the chattiest kind of sort of everything's great in America, even though big things are happening. Here's the opening line. This will be the last presidential campaign of the century, and in many respects, it bids fair to be one of the most interesting and most important. The results of the Spanish War was to involve the United States in new and vast responsibilities. Whether rightly or wrongly, that's key, whether rightly or wrongly, we have the Philippines, Cuba. But wait, there's more. We have the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Hawaii on our hands. What shall we do with them? Yes, Mrs. Smith, what shall we do with them? So, you see that rightly or wrongly. That's where the both sides comes from. And throughout this thing, it tells the seller to make sure that they point out that this is a nonpartisan book. But how do you sell the merchandise? Well, you sell the campaign. This campaign will be the most interesting and most important campaign either you and I have witnessed, which you hear now, right? Every campaign is the most important one.
I always think it's true.
Yeah. Great issues embodying, I might say, the life of the Republic come to the front, and national leaders must stand the most careful scrutiny. Their real worth must be known, whether they be men of honesty, ability, and experience. And then, in a twist that seems familiar today, it is important to you and me whether the trusts shall boss everything. So that's Elizabeth Warren. So, you go through the book. It goes on for pages about how I'm supposed to instruct the sales the person who's buying it, and then we will close on the hard sell at the end. If after showing you everything that's in this book and all the pictures, here's the script for how it's supposed to end. Now, Mr. Blank. Everybody wants this new and fresh campaign book, which, as you see, will be a book of lasting value, for it contains the history of the past and present, which one needs frequently for reference. And here is a place for your name. Now, Mr., and then it has instructions, handing him your pencil and pointing at the line on which you would like him to subscribe. Because remember, I'm just coming to show him the teaser. He's going to write his name, and then I'll deliver the full book for you. Everyone who has seen this prospectus seems to be pleased with it. You will see from these names, parentheses, showing your list of subscribers, what kind of people are attracted by it. And I'm sure you will agree that you want your name down with the rest. Then it gives a little more instruction.
From this nudge, peer pressure.
Yes, exactly. From this point forward, we leave the agent to execute his own tact and judgment. Be careful never to allow your customer to say no. If it appears that he is about to do so, turn quickly to some interesting picture or subject and begin to explain it or read some passage that will please him. Never lose your self-possession. This is the critical point. And your tact and skill must all be brought to bear at this place to book the order. So, these days, of course, are gone. No one sells their books in person before it's completed using deceptive and marginally entertaining patter. That's done now by Amazon, that puts up an early link to the book.
It's called Pleading Emails?
It's called The Hardest Job, $14.99.
$14.99, no.
Act now, ladies and gentlemen. You know the kinds of people who will be buying this book, and you will want to count yourselves among them.
All right, so my chatter is also like, it's a, like a John Dickerson chatter, actually.
Is it going to go on as long?
Not quite.
Okay.
It will feature presidential audio tape, though. So some of you who know me know that I have a real thing about pandas, which is that I cannot stand them. I think they're fraudulent and lazy and neutered and ill-tempered. And I grew up in Washington, D.C., and if you grew up in Washington, D.C. in the 70s, you were constantly dragged to the zoo to see this pair of pandas that Mao gave to Nixon in 1972 when the U.S. opened diplomacy with China. And these pandas would sit lumpishly, drearily, occasionally mauling a keeper or failing to breed, and then when they did manage to breed, they would then sit on the baby that they had and suffocate it. But they got away with it because Americans were duped by the kind of fancy paint job and the elegant fur. Since then, pandas have become this tool of Chinese diplomacy, and China rents pandas to the United States at extortionate rates. You get a panda breeding pair. There, I think there are four or five of them now in the U.S., but China maintains ownership of all cubs that are born. So after when a cub hits 4 years old, they exfiltrate the cub back to China. And now pandas are getting caught up in the Trump trade war because there's a 20-year lease on a pair of pandas in Washington, which are the marquee pandas, the D.C. pandas. And there's this fear that China is going to refuse to renew that lease when it comes up next year. And there's a worry that they're going to be sent home. I'm not worried about this.
We could have a panda war.
Yes, there could be a panda war. I'm not worried about this, but the Washington Post is worried about it. And the Washington Post historically assigns more reporters to the panda beat than it does to, like, HHS. I just want to celebrate a really great piece of they did last month where they talked about the fact that these pandas could get sent back to China. And it turns out they uncovered an amazing piece of audio tape, which is that Richard Nixon, when the pandas came to originally in 1972, was obsessed with the pandas. And he had some of the same interests that I do in pandas. And so there was this wonderful conversation that he had with a Washington Star reporter that he wanted to hype about the pandas arriving. But Nixon had some reservations. So we're just going to play the tape of Nixon talking to this Washington Star reporter.
Now, as a matter of fact, let me tell you an interesting thing about that. You must not. You can only use on your own if you want. But I was just talking to Rob Haldeman, who talked to his Chinese hosts, and this question of mating is very interesting. These are the male and the female.
Uh-huh.
The problem with however, with pandas is that they don't know how to mate. The only way they learn how is to watch other pandas mate, you see? And so they're keeping them there a little while, these are younger ones, to sort of learn, you know, how it's done.
Learn the ropes.
Now, if they don't learn it, they'll get over here, nothing will happen. So I just thought you should have your best reporter out there to see whether these pandas have learned. So now that I've given you the story of pandas, let me let you get back to your more serious questions.
And he was right. Those pandas didn't learn anything. They failed entirely. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by the Twin Cities' own Jocelyn Frank.
Woo!
Our researcher is also a Midwesterner, Chicago's Bridget Dunlap. Faith Smith and Britt Pulley pulled together this show here in St. Paul, thanks to the Fitzgerald Theater for hosting us. Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of Slate Podcast. June Thomas is the managing producer. You should follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest and tweet your chatter to us. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for having us here, St. Paul. We'll talk to you next week. All right, friends. Thank you for the cheers. You can keep that up in a second. We're going to have questions. So we're going to have a brief Q&A. So if you want to come, there's mics stage left, stage right.
Yeah, hi. Joe Biden's age and capacity is kind of an open discussion, especially since Julian Castro's attack on him during the debates, which seemed to fail miserably in the polls and in the media. So I'm wondering, is there a more politically expedient or polite or civil way for other candidates to bring up that issue? And maybe more importantly, do they have a responsibility to, even if it's not politically expedient, given the stakes of the situation?
It's a great question. The first real campaign I covered was Bob Dole in 1996, and this was a big question with Dole, too, and none of the candidates could figure out a way to do it. And also in his case, and as it is a little bit with Biden, too, it's a stalking horse for other stuff, which is we think he's too moderate and all that. I don't know that there's a way to bring it up successfully. I mean, I think basically the way the smart candidates have done it is push him into corners about things from the past, which when he talks about them, A, he's constrained by the politics of the time. B, he knows that, so you can see in his head him trying to figure out who he's going to offend and why and what he has to say, which is just hard and complicated. And then three, he'll tend to use expressions that I remember when Bob Dole referred to the Brooklyn Dodgers. You know,
record
it was
player was in that category.
Yeah, except the thing is he was hipper than he knew, because my son and daughter both have record players and play records all the time. So it's a lot of people are playing records again. But
he was with the youth.
Yeah, but I think that's probably the best way for them to do it
over here.
So I've been thinking a lot about federalism lately, as we all want to do, particularly in light of the Trump administration's challenge of California's restrictions on emissions. And I'm wondering what all of you, particularly Emily, thinks about this kind of flip-flopping of partisanship when it comes to federalism and states' rights.
I mean, you put that so well, and I'm so glad you brought up this issue. It is pretty amazing to see, particularly the lawyers in the Justice Department make these arguments, which are so contrary to positions that Republicans in particular have taken in the past, not just about states' rights and the kind of longer term, like disfavored history of that term, but also just the idea that we live in a laboratory of democracy and states should be able to have a lot of policymaking authority because they are closer to the voters than this federal government. So it is amazing to see people abandon that position when it's no longer the policy answer that they want the states to be giving.
Hi there. The term socialism seems to be a profanity these days that's used by the president and the right wing. Is there a way that the left can recover that word and really actually show its definition so that the people that would benefit most from those policies could actually fight for it?
There's a bunch of great quotes about this. There's Truman's famous one about Republicans always calling things socialists that are...
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.